for those of you who haven't read the profiles of our panelists while these guys are getting set up, Anna Marie Phelps is extremely well known both in UK and international circuits. She's presently chairing the International Working Group on Women and Sport whilst it's has the UK Secretariat from 2022 up until 2026, when there is going to be a great big global conference in Birmingham. She also chairs the European Olympic Committee. She's a member of the executive committee and chairs the Gender Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Working Group of there, Vice Chair of the British Olympic Association and President of European Rowing, in which she was a top-level athlete. Jimena, who will be joining us online, is the Secretary General, the CEO of the Pan Am Sports Federations, and she took on that role shortly before the recent Chile 2023 Pan Am Games, but she has been vice president of it for 8 years. She's a member of the IOC Olympism 365 Commission, so very well connected there. David, we already met this morning, has given us a presentation. What we didn't hear from David, who heads up the major events at Agreco, is he's coming up to his 25-year anniversary at the company. Correct? And last but certainly not least, our only Glaswegian on the panel, David, with a slightly Atlanta, Georgia accent, which is where he emanates from. David and I have been... we've been friends for more than 20 years when he was sports director at the IPC, International Paralympic Committee. Used to be a wrestler, so don't argue with David. Amongst other things, he ran the Commonwealth Games here in Glasgow, very successful, and then went on to lead the Commonwealth Games Federation, and he's now the Chief Innovation Officer and People, or Chief Partnerships, at the Centre for Sport and Human Rights, which is a tremendous organisation. Got a huge event coming up on the 5th and 6th of December in Geneva. David and I have 1,272 mutual LinkedIn connections, so I guess we mix in similar circles. And they are going to give you some fantastic insights about not only the fact that events really are a platform to drive change in sustainability and equality, but how this happens and how it can be done. And we've already covered a number of fairly important topics, and really the common theme, the common strand which has gone through a lot of them is sustainability is very much on everyone's agenda. Anna Marie, if I could throw to you first of all, when it comes really to the fact of the matter that events are a great platform, they raise awareness in the city, in the country, globally.
Yes, no, totally. I mean, it's really interesting. I sit on an IOC commission as well, the gender equality one, and that one of the two, in fact, the top priority for next year for the IOC in terms of inclusion is to use the Olympic Games as the most sort of influential platform to accelerate and promote gender equality. So I think most people, there's no doubt that the number of eyeballs, the sort of the scale of major games like the Olympics, like to some extent the European Games and what we do within each community can have a huge impact. And you know, we've seen that growth in participation of girls in sport. I mean, I was inspired by seeing 100 years ago Nadia Comaneci and Olga Korbut do their bit. And back in the 70s, it was probably the only time you saw women doing sport on TV. But it certainly inspired me to want to be active and you know, beg for a leotard. So, you know, we are seeing an enormous sort of growth in women's sport, and it is because of those big events and those big festivals where they really do sort of showcase women's sport. And so I'm delighted both from an European Olympic Committee's perspective with my Olympian hat on and also from an IWG. But I think there's a lot more we need to do in this space. You know, we saw how London changed the way that the Paralympic Games was viewed and was a real sort of dial changer on that. But we're not doing enough. We're still not seeing enough. And we need to make sure that we're looking at every possible way, you know, to bring diversity in sport and sporting field. And I throw a slightly controversial, not controversial one, but just throw into the room, you know, the number of non-white athletes that we see, in particularly across Europe, is still not there. I mean, we do that quite well, but once we move up and into sort of more leadership roles, that's not happening and it's not being seen. So there's a lot more work to do in this area.
David.
Yes.
Your insights across many different areas, perhaps also from the IPC role that you had back then when it comes to the inclusion aspects of parasport and just how... Yeah, game-changing, it's proven also for para-athletes, but also people with a disability in public life, across society.
Yeah, I think, you know, really as, you know, you've heard me say this before, many of you that have listened to me, you know, we're in the business of creating people's proudest moments. And, you know, having worked for the IPC for a number of years where I cut my teeth, it was really the experience that we tried to deliver day in and day out was regardless of the adaptations, access considerations we needed to make, we wanted people to be treated with dignity, be able to independently mobilize themselves around the experience, and ultimately at the end of the day, get the testimony that this was a world-class, once-in-a-lifetime experience that I'll never forget. So it really doesn't matter what diversity you represent or what special... It's does the environment that we've created welcome you, and has it taken into consideration everything to really make sure that that experience is fulfilling and meaningful? And so really when I look at this, it's about how do we create, engineer, educate, and innovate around not only managing risk that's associated with these issues quite often, but the huge potential and opportunities for developing new markets for wider groups of people that, in many cases in our society, are often marginalized. And so, yeah, it's about building the environment that we want to see. And it's a particular angle, but I'll build off of that when we start to get into human rights discussions and other aspects.
David, you have a pretty challenging task when it comes to energy. And it's, of course, one strand of sustainability when it comes to that environmental aspect. And you're trying to basically reposition, repurpose. And there's a lot of innovation coming out of the company in how to be able to do that.
Yes, it is working, yeah. So, not long ago, I had a friend's dinner, and they were basically comparing how much solar they were getting from their roof, and they were making a competition. And I was saying, well, basically that's where we need to go with events also. The problem is that we are far from that, because obviously events, and the good news is we can talk not only sports here, it's everything, music, like Tom said this morning, for venues, it's cities when they do city festivals, and it's sporting events when they come on. Is that, well, energy is part of it, it's a big part of it, and it's obviously there is a lot of focus on energy, and it's one of the easy ones to tackle if you want to get sustainable, but it's only a part of a complete supply chain. So I never like, just because of for the passion of the industry, to talk only about industry, about energy, even if that's what we are doing. But here you have really a responsibility which is divided. Basically, the supply chain needs to offer the event organizer, the federation, the association, the possibility to implement sustainable solutions. That's our responsibility and the responsibility of the supply chain. That means that we need to invest in new technology. That means that we need to invest in young, bright kids. We need to do a lot of investments, which I believe the supply chain is doing. But at the end, we can only offer it. It's the event organizer, the major event organizer, the city, who has to take it on board and at the end to pay for it. And that's where I think at the moment, from the supply chain, so the event suppliers, there is massive investments, there is commitment. There is commitment also in our own operations to do our best. At the other side, yeah, as we have discussed throughout this conference, yeah, budgets are still budgets, and budget is still a retainer to go all the way. Certainly there are organizations, and some of them have been up here, who are really doing much more, but I think, well, my message is the solutions are there. We need to move and change, and it's the responsibility of everybody to implement the solutions.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah, I mean, great insights and different things. Moving on to having this opportunity to showcase best practices at events. We heard also in the first panel this morning, when it comes to equality, when it comes to showcasing the positioning of different events on the schedule, not only going with the traditional model of always having kind of the blue ribbon event for the men as the final event. This has been something that I have to give a shout out to the IOC, have done a lot of work in this area over the last more than 5 years now to make sure that there's a really nice balanced programming. We heard it here when it came to the UCI championships, the cycling championships, and the final women's event. Krakow, you had some good experiences there when it came to the European Games, and perhaps some other ones you'd like to share.
I think you know, Krakow was fantastic, and it for lots of different reasons. I would say probably scheduling was not one of the most innovative parts of it, but certainly from a sustainability perspective, there were real efforts to make sure that we weren't using waste in a wasteful way, that we were recycling waste. Any extra food was also sent off to food banks, things like that. So there was a lot of really good practice from that perspective. And in terms of not building new infrastructure, I think we had 32 sports. 18 of the venues that we used were refurbished for the local people to continue to. They were venues that were being used and facilities used already for sports. So investment into those, and I think two new facilities were built for those out of those 32 sports and reused throughout the period. So it was great from that perspective. I think in terms of scheduling, that there's still a lot of work that sport in general can do. And we've seen that if you do put things on at prime time, people will watch them. If you do put sports into great stadia, people want to go and see them. Women's football is a great case in point for that. We've done quite a lot of work in rowing to integrate our para-rowing events into our European Championships, for example, and World Championships, and making sure that they're on at times when people will stay and watch them. And there's always pressure, especially if they're a slightly smaller event, to put them on at a less popular time, but you have to sort of push quite hard. Traditionally, we've always had the men's event, the men's eight, as the blue ribboned event at the end of our championships. And at world level now, we alternate the women's and the men's. And it makes no difference. People don't switch their TV off. They still watch it. It gives the women's event a little bit more sort of promotion and credence. And you know, and it's increased the number of women who are wanting to row. They see that it's there in the same way, at a bigger scale. They see that with women's football and things. There's obviously something good happening.
We'll definitely get there because we are in the Centre for Technology and Innovation. So. And we are discussing quite a bit about technology, so for sure we'll get there. In the meantime, you're just being kept entertained. But fortunately, we've got a fantastic panel who've got a lot of good stuff to say. David, I think it's time now to hit the policy advocacy. Now, one of the things that Major Events does is it's basically bringing together diverse stakeholders with different interests, and we have such a great opportunity to really complement each other's work, but also to use this as a terrific platform. Go for it.
Okay. We've been working under very hierarchical structures for a long time. And we've been competing in an industry, competing, that looks to control, and by its nature creates conflict, because there's competition. We're competing for viewers, we're competing for dollars or pounds or whatever. We're competing. The reality is that the world is changing. And instead of these hierarchical models, every one of us starts talking about ecosystems. Ecosystems very much are driven on the basis of collaboration, on the basis of complementary work, and having the conscientious symbiosis. And that evolves where we revolve in a hierarchy. The reason I say this is because the strategies that we've been working are fairly siloed. And what that requires us to do now, today, is to work on strategies that are much more integrated, taking public, private, third sector into account, which also takes in social, economic, and environmental drivers into account. We all talk about the impact of sport. We all want to achieve that impact. The reality is that the legitimacy and trust in that impact is only viable as it's sustainable and responsible now. And so the reality is we need good strategies that bring everyone together, public, private, third sector partners, recognizing everyone's roles, responsibilities, their rights, the risks that they bring and have the potential of causing in terms of harm, but also the opportunities. And when we do that, we can actually drive good policy formation, start to look at how we can reach social ambitions as well as environmental ambitions and this beautiful economic prosperity that we promised with sport. So really the reality is that we are looking at a fundamental shift in how we structure ourselves, the systems that we work within, and ultimately that's going to change the type of leadership that's required and the way that we look at the products we deliver, the appeal of those products, and who we're offering it to. I can tell you that my two kids right now have a very, very different, I would say, consumer view on the products that they will buy and what they will watch and what it means to them. And I look to them for advice constantly to make sure, is this meeting the grade in terms of inclusion, in terms of impact, in terms of really values-based, impact-driven, purpose-led, the VIP framework. That's really, really what I think is going to drive us forward, particularly around issues of sustainability and the broader issues of inclusivity.
You brought the kids up well, David. Good to hear.
Brought me up well.
So, Ximena, I can tell from the expression on your face you can hear us.
Perfectly well, thank you.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations on the recent Pan Am Games that were very successfully carried out in Chile. Tell us about great best practice examples that you've got, that you showcased there. We followed from afar, but from the person who had to deliver it.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, we're very happy indeed. I think there were fantastic games, but especially we were able to apply certain best practices that we had been thinking for. Remember that we were in the pandemic with you during the preparation of the game, so that really kind of set us back in some stages, especially, of course, the construction. But it also gave us a little bit of time to think about other best practices that would work. For instance, one, and it goes back to what you were mentioning right now, we signed a memorandum of understanding with one of the most specialized universities of journalism in Santiago. So we put a group together of 25 female students and 25 male students of journalism that were able to help us at a program, a very special program. They were writing and covering all the stories of the games, and they were focusing exactly on gender equality, on inclusion, on bringing these values to our games. And of course, this is something that we made available to all the press around the world. We were putting up these newsletter bulletins, and of course with nice photographs and everything. But this, I think, was helping a lot. I think it's part of the legacy. We had other best practices also that I think, you know, were driving the games to more ESG values, because I do believe that our young people are focusing on different things and they're consuming different things. And I think that we were able to put together the Safe Sport Protocol, for instance, and this is something that I think we're going to look at it at all the events coming in the future. I think it's very important that we focus on that, but also making it known to the society, like telling them, yes, we are bringing these games. We're a group of foreigners, athletes, and sports leaders, and we're putting together these, but we need these values to be kept well. And we're going to respect, of course, the national laws, but we also have a different code of ethics, the Safe Sport Protocol. And this was also something very amazing as well, Sarah. We also focused on the village, and this is something that the corporation, which is the organizing committee in Santiago, was very focused in. It was the village was a social project for housing. And I think everything over there, once it was built and when it was set up, was focusing on having a green village. And I think that at the end of the day, this transforms the communities. We also had the look of the games. It was 100% recyclable material. And I think that's also very helpful. And this is something, of course, that I think something most of the organizing committees will carry on. And I do think it's very important to see to bring now the social legacy, you know, not only bring the infrastructure and also something for the first time that Pan Am Sports, and this is under the leadership of our president, Neven Illich, who was very focused. He's Chilean. So he decided from the very beginning and with the organizing committee and with Pan Am Sports that we didn't want to leave these big infrastructures behind. We have to think about the population, about the sports that are really played there and the sports that want to be promoted. And all the seating spaces were focused on that. They were small for some sports when it comes to the Pan Am Sports region. But we understood that it was also part of a good legacy. We wanted infrastructures to be used later and really to be enjoyed by the population. We don't want to be a burden. The organizing of the games have to be really something that they appreciate, you know, the community, the people, and I think that was a very good target. So yes, we're very happy for that, Sarah.
Well, it was. You were certainly worth waiting for, Jimena, and thanks for giving us such a broad overview in different areas. One of the things you've touched on, sustainable environmental practices, David, we had a great discussion about SailGP, they've really been lauded and held up as one of the really good citizens, and you're going to give us some insights in that regard.
Yes, indeed. When we prepared the panel, we were thinking a life example always works. So basically, the credit needs to go to SailGP as a customer and as an organization. So very fancy sailing ships, very niche port, but really innovated their concept in the way that basically they have the normal racing where you get points, but next to that and equal to that, they have the purpose league. So basically the teams can win points, which are valid for the championship, on how they behave from a social, sustainable point of view. So what SailGP has been asking us is to implement a system of live monitoring of the energy consumption of every user. So basically we monitor the teams and their energy consumption, but we also monitor the own operations of SailGP. And so there is a league table, and basically there you can get again points if you are the less energy or you are the best friendly user of energy, you will get points. And I think it's a you could laugh, but it's a very smart way of engaging all your stakeholders. I'm looking at Julio, who will present tomorrow. I mean, imagine that that we would give OBS some points for their energy consumption in the Olympic Games. I don't think they would win, but it's the way you deal with it. And energy is only one part. Again, I mean, they are looking with structures with solar on top of it. I think CLGP is doing something which can be an example for a lot of organizations and. Yeah, it's really, really pushing us, the supply chain, very far in taking also risks, which you don't see a lot. I mean, our industry is very risk adverse. Like the broadcaster guys were talking, it's a lot of money. But maybe we sometimes need to shift a bit of that a lot of money more into doing it more sustainable.
Absolutely. Just perhaps a couple of words. My sport was skiing. And clearly, the environmental aspects, the natural environment requiring snow has definitely been one of the most in-focus aspects of environmental challenges. And basically, it's a case of trying to be as possible best citizens. You know, there are many communities all over the world, and our friends from Milano Cortina, Giulio, know it very well, that this is all about having sustainability for their existence without tourism and without having winter recreation, at least, if not sport, those communities just wouldn't exist. And there are many that are closing or they're transitioning to use that wonderful mountain environment for other activities. So this is a reality of climate change, and this is something that has to be addressed. You've given a positive shout out to CLGP, also from the International Biathlon Union, is a federation who's really trying to engage together with all of their organisers to promote sustainable practices so that the events are carried out in a much more a sustainable way, recognising and addressing the problem rather than, as it were, denying it or just trying to walk away from it and going somewhere else where the problem doesn't exist. So that's very much something that we're seeing, and they've initiated an interesting project there. I'm Vice President of the Sustainable Mountain Alliance. We're collaborating together with them on their activities. Collaborations and partnerships, I think, David, we've touched on that very much. Community engagement. Ultimately, one of the key focal areas for a host city to organise an event, a country, a region, when it comes to events like Pan Am Games, when it comes to a major event like the Olympics, it's the entire country who's getting behind it. It's not only about the 14 days or however long of competition, but it's really what is that doing for the community and how important is that? And your insights, please.
I ask a quick question to the audience. How comfortable are you, and be vulnerable here, with the terms human rights? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you think you understand it? A few. Okay. It's a really interesting point. When we talk about people, we talk about human rights. We're talking about human-centric thinking. We're looking at how we respect, protect, and promote one another. That is the starting base for community engagement. It's actually talking to all the people, including all the people, and there's a three-step process to good community engagement. Inclusion. Include everyone. Don't let anyone behind, even the difficult voices. Unpopular voices, those that you don't want to hear. Listen to their experiences as well as try to understand the facts. They don't always match up. People's perceptions are not necessarily always the reality, but it is the start to a process, and that's really important. Poverty is one of the great things that we have to deal with when we're hosting major events. and we don't deal with it very well. Do we run into the fire and actually go to some of those communities that are underserved? Some events do. Great regeneration efforts do that really, really well. Some do it really, really poor. But it is going and speaking with people, listening to their experiences, and aligning your work and valuing their input to their ambitions. And once you've included people, you've given them the platform for their voice and the agency around that, that there's not going to be repercussions for speaking truth to power, you can then be responsive. You can then align your strategies to not only mitigating risk, but harnessing the powerful impact that our events can have. But it is a three-step process, and the reality is, if you leave someone out, you're going to get called on it. So now, more than ever, we have an obligation, a responsibility, but also an opportunity to use our events to be agents for change. And that, I really think, is the how you build collaboration and partnerships is building trust with legitimate engagement that leads to really credible action and impactful returns.
Can I mean, I think, you know, as sport particularly, if I'm speaking as sport, I think we have a real opportunity to do that. And I think sport's really working quite hard on it at the moment. We've seen the introduction of refugee teams, for example, which is giving some space and some airtime for people who otherwise would never have that opportunity to tell their story. And in Krakow, we had a refugee team in a Continental Games for the first time, which was a big step forward for us to really bring that down into people's sort of down their TV screens and into their lives, which is really important. One of the other things, and I think if you're, we always have to be careful as sport not to overpromise what we can deliver with a major event. You know, we could promise the moon and stars, and particularly when we're trying to sell it to a host city or whatever, this will transform your city or your country or whatever else. But it can have those really transformational things, and often real culture change and transformation comes with some sort of form of regulation or legislation and things like that. And one great example that I love from Krakow was, you know, when we attributed the games to them, or shortly after, I think it was, the region and the city made that region and city an LGBT-free zone. And then it was very controversial at the time. But, you know, the media got behind this and gave them a bit of a hard time. There were real fears of Krakow losing and Malopolska losing the games because of that. And in 2020, there was an announcement that they were withdrawing the declaration on anti-LGBT, that actually they put forward a declaration that was promoting diversity and inclusion. And it's really changed that whole region. So we can do some really good things with major events, with games, even to the extent that the, you know, that sort of political engagement and political commitment can make a real change to people's lives.
I'll hand quickly back over to you, Sarah. I just wanted to build on what Anna Marie said, is that if you look at Glasgow, and I'm just putting a little plug for Glasgow here, if you look at the work that we did in the lead up to the Commonwealth Games around child rights, the impact that UNICEF has had across all the schools across Scotland because of that, and kids knowing their rights, and, you know, looking at rights-abiding cities, is a lot of work, and we use that on the back of a Games that had children at their heart, because the people of Glasgow said, what would you want if you could have one thing out of the Games? Hopes and dreams for our children. And that was because of the community engagement that we held. So again, it really comes down to having those difficult, open, and safe conversations that you can really make some of these big changes that have an enduring legacy. But I completely take the point. Don't promise the moon and, you know, deliver stardust. You really need to make sure it is deliverable, and be honest when you can't deliver it.
Sometimes things come out of it they didn't expect, so we didn't necessarily expect this. Yeah.
Small wins can be just as important. Jimena, we've already had the signal that it's countdown time, but please don't leave us, because the poll is going to be conducted as with a show of hands, because as you can see, our technology is being used for ulterior reasons, which is for Ximena, who's going to give us your final concluding thought.
I just wanted, this is a very interesting point for me. Just, I just want to be very punctual in saying two cases that we had as an example exactly of human rights on one side and also of the different situations and the social legacy. We had, for instance, a Chilean athlete that he had been in the country. Since Chile doesn't have a law of refugees, he wouldn't make it to the team. It was very difficult for him. He was very powerful in his message, and he finally was able to get the nationality and participate in the games. But it was very important for us that when he won the gold medal in Decathlon, it was very interesting what he said, and he told his story, and this is something that left something behind. I think it's very important that we hear these messages, we hear these voices, and actually the games give that opportunity. And just, I'm going to be very brief. I'm going to leave something out in the air. I just want to tell you something that happened at the Central American and Caribbean Games this year in El Salvador. And it has to do a lot with the human rights situation and what they have been living in that country. And we didn't want to actually put a name on it. We didn't really decide if it was something we wanted. This was not our decision. They have a group of the prisoners they called Deprived of Liberty. These people, that young people especially, that are in the prisons now, and the organizing committee, somehow the government put them to work at the games. So it was a very difficult situation, but they were there at the closing ceremony. We praised their work because they were taking care of different activities in the construction, in the stadium, in the cleaning of the village. They worked for the games. They had a social program of reinsertion to society. When they worked like for a shift of 8 hours, they would get 2 days off their sentences. And well, it's something that I leave out in the air because we don't want to say if it would work in other countries, but it was something that the games left, and this was a community engagement that was very powerful during the games, and it was, of course, astonishing to a lot of the society. So I just want to appreciate the fact that I'm here, and it was very interesting to hear you all.
Well, that's pretty hard to beat, isn't it? And as we said in our pre-discussion, it's always great to give you real-life cases. You know, just explaining the theory of what and why and how is one thing, but when you hear stories like that, that's what you're going to go home and you're going to talk about with your families, or when you're in the pub, or wherever.